Welcome to the Supplement Engineer Podcast. My name is Robert Chinetsky. Joining us today is the CEO of Drink HRW, Mr. Alex Tarnava. Alex, welcome to the show. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. First-time guests on the show, the listeners are familiar with this. I always like to get the background story. How did you get into this crazy industry that is the supplement world? We all come from very, very different backgrounds and all that. It's always a unique experience. So I like to kind of see where you started from and what made you decide to jump into this realm.
Sure. Now, long, middle, short version, because it's a pretty long story.
Mm-hmm.
How long do you want me to go?
I mean, it's as long as much time as you have, man. I'm here to jam all day, so I've got everything blocked out. As long as you want to.
Sure. So it's a long story. I won't give like all the nitty gritty details, but basically, you know, six seven years ago, I was training 6+ hours a day, you know, between martial arts, CrossFit, hikes, my own training. And I caught something. I was sick. They still don't know what I had, but I basically my C-reactive proteins were something like 80 times higher what they should be. I was crippled with inflammation. I had central nervous system, you know, shut down. I couldn't jump an inch off the ground. Right. I couldn't do anything explosive. I went from being able to do string together like 20 bar muscle ups to I couldn't do one chest bar, but I had no problem doing chin ups. Right. Mm-hmm. I couldn't jump off the ground, but my deadlift and my squat and my bench press were normal. Right. It seemed like slow, you know, heavy movements were fine, but mm-hmm. I just had nothing. I also was sleeping like 16 to 18 hours a day. I was just out like all the time and I'd fall asleep. If I sat down on the couch for like a minute and stopped moving, I'd fall asleep. So they were doing blood work like once, twice a week at the end, trying to figure out what was wrong. At the same time, my best friend and roommate at the time, he was a guy that would like top 10 in triathlons and Spartan races, stuff like that. He missed 3 weeks of work to pneumonia, right? And he had to go to the hospital a couple of times. So it hit us very, very different. But it must have been the same thing that both of our bodies were just kind of in a panic mode from. When the dust settled and all of this went away, my shoulder froze. Or it didn't freeze yet, sorry, like, but it hurt a lot and I lost some mobility. You know, like I couldn't properly do like snatches, for instance. I'd have to loosen up my shoulder for like 15 minutes to be able to get into the position. So that was bugging me. And then when that didn't get away, I started getting some imaging done. Turned out I'd developed in short order, osteoarthritis, you know, that was at the moderate stage. Mm-hmm. So probably that elevated inflammation just wreaked havoc, you know, caused, it was an old football injury. I'd, you know, broken my arm quarter inch below and it was, you know, pierced through the muscle. So I went on like a high dose of like anti-inflammatories, about 1,000 milligrams a day of naproxen. I was doing cortisone injections, right? But I knew that wasn't a forever solution, right? So I was scouring PubMed, anything that seemed to be able to help to regulate the inflammatory process. I kept on finding hydrogen water, you know, molecular hydrogen. I bought this machine that was like $5,000 and I just started taking it. Long story short, about 8 months after I started the injections and then naproxen, I fainted a few times in the gym, right? I guess I developed multiple ulcers, you know, and wasn't properly processing, you know, my nutrients.
Right.
So I had to abruptly stop the naproxen and my shoulder completely froze, right? From there, you know, I went back to PubMed, you know, what can I do? Right. Cause I couldn't put on a jacket, couldn't put on a shirt, couldn't do anything at that point because I continued abusing my shoulder, you know, with my activities while taking all these anti-inflammatories. So my damage had gotten worse. I mean, at that time I could still loosen my shoulder up to do exercises even after I stopped the anti-inflammatories, but it would take 15-20 minutes of stretching, getting into it. But when I'd wake up in the morning, I couldn't put on a shirt because it would have frozen overnight. Yeah. I found quite a number more studies in like, you know, the 8 months, there was even more studies on hydrogen water. And that really annoyed me because I'm like, well, clearly this $5,000 machine, you know, I bought didn't work, you know, it's not working. But then I got deeper into some of these studies, sort of looking at the methodology, concentrations, dosages, how they're making the water. I realized that none of the studies basically were using electrolysis like the machine I bought was, that they were all using different methods. And I realized that the salesman who actually, it was a former staff of mine, he'd never actually told me what the concentration of the machine was, like what levels it was producing. So I got it tested, and at first it didn't detect any hydrogen whatsoever, right? It wasn't making any, you know? So we had to like triple the input, and it was making like 0.03 parts per million of hydrogen gas in the water. For context, the tablets that I ended up developing delivered 12 parts per million. So night and day difference. And
yeah, it's entire order of magnitude difference there.
Yeah, a couple orders of magnitude different. Basically, even the minimum observed therapeutic threshold determined by a group of researchers called the International Hydrogen Standards Association is 0.5 ppm over 1 liter. That doesn't mean it's going to be effective for anything. That is just the lowest dosage that has ever been effective for anything at all, right? Because there's dose-dependent responses, concentration-dependent responses across so many things. You'll get, you know, better benefits faster, right, with higher dosages. But the minimum effect ever seen was 0.5. This was 0.03. Right. Ooh. So it was a $5,000 paperweight, you know. So that made me mad, but it gave me some hope, right? Because I'm like, well, I haven't actually had hydrogen water. You know, I'm just drinking water, yeah. You know, basically. So I started, you know, looking into other products, you know, importing some into Canada. I live in Vancouver, Canada, so most of them were out of the States or Japan. I was trying to get them in. I was still super disenfranchised by a lot of these really early products. Mm-hmm. The claims in this industry, like, I mean, in the supplement industry alone, the claims can be, you know, pretty egregious, but in something that was brand new, like hydrogen water, like, they were claiming to cure cancer and cure every disease. And, you know, like it was unbelievable, you know, how unethical a lot of these marketers were behaving. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the companies that I bought to test from, you know, I guess they were MLM. I didn't even realize. Well, they gave my personal information, right, to one of their like reps to like start calling me to try and convince me to join the MLM, right? And I'm like, man, like this is insane, right? And so I'm testing all these products, and they were better than the paperweight, but they were still like very low. They were all like 0.3, 0.4, 0.5 ppm. So I started, you know, going to the drawing table and trying to figure out how to make these products better. Are they usable at all? So I started really MacGyvering with a lot of them. Caused a couple scares. Like I was building up pressure and stuff and trying to get the right thermoses. I had like thermoses at 50 PSI blow up in my fridge and, you know, breaking and stuff. So I'm like, you know what? I'm like, I just thought to myself, I'm like, why am I giving these companies money when I'm having to spend all this time to modify these products to get them to work?
Yeah.
And not properly, you know what I mean? Like blowing up thermoses in my fridge and stuff, trying to get this stuff to work. And by the way, the reason I was doing this is because within about a week of, you know, rigging some of these products up, I was getting like close to 3 ppm. Mm-hmm. So 10 times higher than they were originally getting.
Right.
And my shoulders started to unloose. I started sleeping better, my pain started going away. So I'm like, okay, so this stuff works, right? Now I'm just trying to figure out how to safely get it to myself and like affordably give it to myself. And then, I'm just thinking like, I don't want to give any of these guys money, just with the way they're presenting the products. So I just started formulating the hydrogen tablets as a DIY project, but I was starting to take some prototypes, but then I had a bit of a sober second thought. I'm like, you know what? Like, I know this stuff well enough to make this, mm-hmm. but I'm not a chemist, right? Like, I just understand the chemistry enough. I'm like, what if there's some side reaction that's going to kill me, mm-hmm. Or like, what if I'm missing something? I think I'm being safe, but elemental magnesium is explosive. It's the white, in fireworks, and hydrogen gas is explosive. I'm like, I really don't want to be a Darwin Award winner, because I think I know what I'm doing, but I don't. Right.
Right.
So I found my founding partner, Dr. Holland. He's a PhD medicinal chemist from the pharmaceutical industry. He runs a team developing drugs at a large pharmaceutical company. At first, he called it the worst pseudoscience he'd ever heard in his life, right? Because it just, at first, hydrogen water being therapeutic for anyone that gets basic physiology and basic, gas chemistry and stuff, it makes no sense. Mm-hmm. It isn't until you start really diving in to the research that's been done and been building and getting stronger and stronger each year that you go, it really changes perspective.
Right.
And that's what I started doing. I kind of rebutted every point he had that was the knee-jerk reaction of why this is stupid and would never work. Mm-hmm. I said, well, this is what this shows, this is what that shows, this is what that shows. Sent him a bunch of publications and got back to me a few days later. And he said, well, I'm surprised, right? But it appears there's enough evidence to, pursue this as a supplement to your own use, right? Mm-hmm. So sure, I'll give you some help. 3 weeks went by. He was tweaking everything I was doing, refining it a bit. I kept on sending him a new study every day, and just kind of serendipitously, I sent him one on hepatitis B. And I didn't know at the time, but that's what he was working at his pharmaceutical company, was small molecule cures for hepatitis B.
Cool. Right?
So he read the paper and he called me for lunch and he's like, listen, he's like, all the other papers are outside of my area. I don't know. I just have to trust the conclusions of the researchers and look at the methods. Mm-hmm. He's like, this isn't, a great study. He's like, but this is an okay study. And this is promising, right? This works from this study, right? Have you thought of commercializing this? And I was playing around with it in my head, but it wasn't really my industry. And I'm like, I thought about it, but I don't know anything about this industry. And he's like, you're going to all this effort to make a DIY project, right? Mm-hmm. There's all this research in this area and there's no one that has a good commercial product. He's like, if you're looking for a partner, I'm in, right? So
sweet.
That's kind of how we got started. I mean, from there, we refined the prototypes in 3 weeks, but making 10 pills in a mortar and pestle, and pressing them by hand, mm-hmm. is a lot easier than making millions at a time, right?
I imagine so.
The equipment you need, the processing aids, everything like that. So to go from the mortar and pestle to our first production-ready tablet then took over 2,000 iterative adjustments, over a year's work, and 15 failed scale-up attempts. Right?
Wow.
By that time, we were really in, by the time we first launched, so many people had known about what we were doing. A lot of companies were like waiting for me to finish to want to private label my technology, right? Because there was one other guy that was, working on it, but he had a tablet that you had to seal basically for 8 hours in a mm-hmm. container, right, to get like 1 ppm. And I'm getting like, over 10, like about 12 now. So from there, we just looked and you know, ideally, and actually it was really, really, you know, good because we did our due diligence on, you know, regulatory, how the system works, you know, before we decided, okay, what type of product is this going to be? You know, we were thinking originally drug, right? But then trying to decide what direction to go with drug, you know, maybe sell the technology to a pharmaceutical company. But the research is just going in so many different avenues. And we're like, man, this is confusing. How is it working in so many different models? Plus, you know, for athletic performance and all these various areas. And it still didn't make sense at the time. Mm-hmm. So upon looking at it, we found, and this is still something most people in the supplement industry don't understand. It is, I mean, a lot of people end up thinking there's a bit of a conspiracy that as soon as something works, Big Pharma shuts it down. Mm-hmm. Well, that's only because of ineptitude from the supplement industry. I'm not kidding, right? We have something called the new dietary ingredient, you know, status mm-hmm. with the FDA. It's estimated only about 4% of ingredients required to have one, right? Okay. You know, most new ingredients manufacturers don't ever file anything with the FDA because the FDA doesn't enforce it, right? They don't enforce it. There's no consequences for not having it. The only consequence is if your ingredient actually works, right? And a public university or the FDA or a drug company or anything decides to use it in a clinical trial, they have to file something called the IND, right? An investigational new drug application. As soon as an IND is filed, if something is not a legal supplement, it becomes illegal for sale and the FDA takes it seriously to try and shut down, you know, some of these goods, especially if a drug company petitions and they say, we are doing extensive clinical research incorporating this ingredient, you know, into our matrix, mm-hmm. and all these supplement companies are selling it illegally. The FDA then steps in and shuts them down, right? You know, so that the drug company can continue doing research. Mm-hmm. So if something is declared as an investigational drug first, it can never be sold as a supplement, right? However, if something is legally filed as a supplement or food, you know, by either an NDI or GRAS, you can then pursue as a drug and you can forever sell as a supplement, right? So getting our NDI, you know, took like 3 years, hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was a massive, you know, portfolio we put together on the safety, our manufacturing, everything to do with that. This mm-hmm. is something most supplement manufacturers don't want to do or care to do, but that is a protection because now we have numerous INDs filed, you know, not through us, but through public research universities. Mm-hmm. You know, so we have, to date, we have 7 clinical trials, you know, published, 3 case studies published, a preclinical study published. We have 15 clinical trials underway, you know, including our biggest one is a phase 3 clinical trial for COVID-19, you know, ongoing in France right now, nationwide, right? We actually have 3 trials for COVID underway right now. We have, you know, big studies in the US, like including, you know, Stony Brook University in New York has, you know, a handful. One is, you know, on Parkinson's disease, with, you know, about 70 people. One is 100 participant post-stroke recovery. They actually published a paper in rats on post-stroke using a combo of our tablets and minocycline that had really good results. So that one, they're hopeful. They have another study looking at you know, quality of life in you know, cancer patients with high-grade gliomas getting chemo and radiation. So we have all of these wide array of clinical research ongoing. We'll never be able to make claims on a lot of this stuff, right? But researchers can be pursuing this, filing the needed INDs, right, to do it while we stay illegal, right? I mean, if we had never filed that NDI, right, and these researchers just bought our product and didn't contact us and filed the IND, we'd now be illegal. And that's what people end up thinking is a conspiracy. And it's no conspiracy. It's just negligence, right? It's negligence from the product manufacturer for not following the law. So, I mean, that's the long and the short of how we got in the supplement industry. I'm pretty glad right now because our research is really pointing us to some cool stuff that the reason it's benefiting so many models but can also benefit, say, athletes, regular people, it is the very mechanisms of how it works, you know, are very similar to, say, exercise. You know, so a lot of our research is on, you know, non-disease metabolic states like metabolic syndrome, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, like pre-diabetic states that you don't get medication for, exercise performance, sleep improvement, right? These areas, you know, are useful to every person. And if we'd gone down the drug route, we'd never have been available, you know, to this wide, you know, range of consumers.
Right. There's a ton to unpack there. I want to rewind back a little bit and go, can we dive into, I guess, a little bit of the mechanistic side of things? So how is molecular hydrogen impacting human physiology? You know, just doing through like a cursory glance through the research on my own, there's over 300 plus studies. They've had a huge meta-analysis on just like in the early days, not even including the stuff y'all have done on that side. So walk the listeners, I guess, through, like, we can start with like a high level approach. And if we want to dial into the weeds a little bit more, we can. But you know, one of the initial reactions I can see from somebody that doesn't really understand this is saying, okay, I'm taking some extra hydrogen, but hydrogen, you know, like hydrogen's in water, it's H2O. So can I just drink a bunch of other water and get a bunch of extra hydrogen in me that way? So walk them through that a little bit and kind of make, you know, separate and piecemeal things out.
So on your last point, you know, we get that. That's one of our most common questions we get. And when you think about that, water, right? H2O, right? Yeah. Hydrogen is attached to the oxygen, so you're not getting the therapeutic benefit of the hydrogen gas because it's bonded to the oxygen. This is the same thing, you know, if people remember, say from high school chemistry, sodium metal is explosive, right? You drop sodium metal in water, it's going to go boom and explode, right? Now, chlorine gas is poisonous, right? You know, you put sodium in, you know, chlorine together, it's sodium chloride, that's table salt. You know, we need it to function, right? So when something is a compound, the sum of the parts don't have the properties of the original parts. And that's the same thing for H2 or H2O, right? So you can't get the medicinal properties of H2 by drinking more H2O. Now, how hydrogen works, and this has been one of the biggest struggles, and there's finally some good hypotheses emerging that need to be, you know, tested. You know, I have my own paper I wrote on this that is not substantially different, but touches on some different things that some of the other researchers have said. So basically, it's been very confusing because hydrogen, now there's about 2,000 publications, you know, in animal models, you know, and in vitro and humans all together. There's, I think it's 111 or 112 papers in humans, like clinical research papers that I've identified to date as of March 3rd, 2021. I keep the most comprehensive database of the human research, you know, out of anyone. A lot of the researchers come to me and ask for studies, send them to me when they find them. It's just so hard to organize all this stuff. Right. You know, I'm on ResearchGate every day, which is basically, ResearchGate is like kind of like LinkedIn, but only for research scientists, right? So I'm just
scrolling. It's a giant repository of all these studies and everything.
Yeah, and you can only communicate, you know, if you have your own publications, right? You know, get access. So I'm there every day. I spend at least, you know, 20 minutes every day trying to search and find new human studies on hydrogen, and letting their algorithms work to like pop them up to me. So, you know, I wrote a book chapter for, and this is crazy how big data works, right? Because I wrote a book chapter a year ago for, you know, Elsevier USA that's in press right now. And we, myself and another researcher that was involved in it, we only were able to find 80 studies, you know, in humans, right? On hydrogen after 3 months of searching, right? You know, when I started letting the algorithm work at ResearchGate, you know, it slowly started picking up and sending them to me. right, onto my newsfeed. And now in the last month, I found 15 more.
Wow.
Right? That just, they're in smaller publications, they're not on PubMed. You know what I mean? Like less impact factors, but they still have useful information.
Yeah.
So that's just a small data set, you know, how these algorithms work. Mm-hmm. You know, that was an example of it being incredibly useful for me, like just finding all this stuff. But anyways, the research is really confusing when you first start diving in, right? The mechanisms are not clear. Hydrogen shown to alter, you know, thousands, something like over 10,000 different, you know, gene expressions, right? Mm-hmm. In some models, it works, you know, seems to be, you know, an antioxidant. In other models, it increases oxidative stress, right? Some models, it's an anti-inflammatory. Other models, it's pro-inflammatory. Some models, it you know, seems to you know, activate autophagy. Others, it inhibits autophagy, right? And we start diving into it. It's always doing it for a beneficial outcome.
Yeah.
Right? Because, you know, and we look at a lot of these things as good or bad, right? But say, for instance, with autophagy, it inhibited autophagy in, say, like models of like cardiac failure, where you wouldn't want autophagy.
Correct.
Right? Seemed to be, you know, acutely increasing oxidative stress, leading to a better endogenous antioxidant response. So that's our body's own production of antioxidants. That's mm-hmm. the same way exercise works, by the way, too.
Right?
It seems to be regulating our, you know, inflammatory response. Inflammation is not a bad thing. That's part of our immune system, mm-hmm. right? So then the question became, how is hydrogen doing this? It seems to be kind of monitoring and correcting and regulating so many of our functions from the redox status, right? Because so many people think, oh, antioxidants are good. Well, that's not necessarily true. You know, most people have too much oxidative stress, especially as we age. However, we need this homeostasis, this harmony between, you know, oxidative stress and antioxidants. In fact, we know that so many, you know, oxidative and nitrogenative stresses in our body have important critical roles as messengers, right, to do things. I mean, nitric oxide is a free radical, you know, in a nitrogenative stress. And the realization of how important it is to our physiology won a Nobel Prize, right? So we don't want to just be flooding ourselves with tons of antioxidants, right? That can have bad side effects, like deleterious side effects. I mean, mm-hmm. they stop dead pretty much every single large study using high-dose antioxidant therapy, right? Because as the results started pouring in, it showed that high-dose antioxidants led to higher all-cause mortality, right? Higher rates of cancer, interfered with cancer treatments, right? Because the issue isn't flooding ourselves with antioxidants. It's finding that right harmony between antioxidant levels and oxidative stress.
Right.
That's one of the reasons hydrogen seems to be so profound, is it seems to regulate both, you know, our antioxidant production by the NRF2 pathway for glutathione, superoxide dismutase, catalase, but it also seems to play a role in regulating like nitric oxide synthase and H2O2, you know, and some of the oxidative stressors.
Yeah.
So it drives toward this redox homeostasis, right? This harmony between, you know, the two sides.
Mm-hmm.
Now the question is how and why, right? And that's been a bigger question, because we thought hydrogen gas was inert, right? Mm-hmm. And also, why does hydrogen water seem to work better than inhaling the gas, even at 100 times less of a dose, right? That's right. The second question. Why is this working better? Well, this is starting to make a lot more sense, because as we discover more and more, look deeper into our history, into our evolution, you know, and start to understand the microbiome, it all starts clicking together, right? All these thoughts are starting to come together. We can produce up to like 10 liters a day of hydrogen gas in our body. And we do this through, you know, bacteria in our small intestines breaking down carbohydrates, right? Mm-hmm. So it's this constant little flow of hydrogen coming, right? Especially most people nowadays, you know, we're eating all the time. We're eating carbohydrates all the time, mm-hmm. you know, so we're always producing hydrogen gas. There's always this basal level of hydrogen gas in every cell in our body. So again, why does drinking a bit of hydrogen gas in water, you know, our tablets is the highest dose and concentration on the market, but it still only might give you 80 milliliters of gas, you know, when you drink down half a liter or 16 ounces. Mm-hmm. I was getting in this 80 milliliters beneficial when we're producing 10 liters a day. You know, we look at that and even a lower dose, like, you know, 1/10 of our dose doubles the Cmax. So like the concentration of gas in the cell for about 5 minutes, right? So it's this acute spike.
Fascinating.
Right? You know, so this small dose is doubling our cellular concentrations and we're giving about 10 times higher dose right then. Mm-hmm. So we're spiking up the concentration. Then we start looking into things like when we give continuous dosing to say rodents, mm-hmm. there's no benefits. But when we give these acute doses to rodents, that's when we see the benefits. Same thing in cell cultures, right? You know, just if you continuously dose it, right, in healthy cells, nothing happens, right? Mm-hmm. But when you're giving these acute blasts, when there's damage present, that's when we're seeing all these changes. So it comes into, you know, there's some sort of a regulatory role of hydrogen gas in our cells. Now we start going back into, you know, the history of hydrogen gas, you know, and evolution. Well, hydrogen played an integral role, you know, in our planet's atmosphere, right? You know, basically it was, hydrogen was largely at play for why we developed an oxygen-rich atmosphere to keep it short. It was critical for the development of all life on the planet. In fact, our mitochondria evolved from a hydrogen-dependent organelle, mm-hmm. right? So an organelle that used hydrogen as a fuel source. Now, even within our body right now, the bacteria, we have hydrogen-producing bacteria and hydrogen-consuming bacteria, right? You know, in our body. So this brings us back to the hydrogen water part. Well, hydrogen water seems to raise cellular concentrations, you know, as well as hydrogen inhalation does, but inhalation won't get into your gut, whereas hydrogen water is bringing this extra hydrogen down to all your bacteria. Right. There's a couple of human studies and about 10 others, you know, in various other animals from rodents to goats to pigs that show that hydrogen water, right, not on inhalation, but hydrogen water improved the microbiome, right? So, you know, there's this at play here, which can really further be shown by all water might have been hydrogen rich because all the oldest water sources on the planet that we've discovered mm-hmm. have been rich in hydrogen gas. I mean, they found water sources that are billions of years old, say at the Canadian Shield when they drill down like, you know, a mile into the earth, and there's detectable hydrogen gas in those water sources, right? Okay. Then you get into, say, you know, our hunter-gatherer stage, like the paleo period of humanity, we weren't going to have access to food, right? Like we do now, mm-hmm. right? We might not have eaten for 2 days. Then one day we would have eaten only meat, no carbohydrates. Then we might have found some vegetables or fruits or grains and binged on carbs, and we would have gotten this huge spike in hydrogen production, mm-hmm. right? We look at it and compare it to something like exercise. And these stressors are called, you know, it's called hormesis, mm-hmm. but basically what it means is our bodies have adapted to anticipate and expect these stresses, right? And our systems are designed to anticipate. If you are sedentary and you don't work out at all, you become unhealthy, right? All your systems become dysregulated, dyshomeostatic. Yep. Same thing happens if you exercise all day, every day, and never give yourself a break, right? It's overexercise. Then we look at things like if you do the same exercise every day in the same manner, it's no longer exercise. And you start losing all the benefits, you know, of exercise. Right. Well, with our modern diet, we have hydrogen in the same amounts in our cells all the time, right? So it seems like it's logical that we're losing the benefits of hydrogen acting as kind of this regulator in our cells and you know, adapting us to go back towards healthy functioning homeostasis. Mm-hmm. So what we need is these acute blasts of hydrogen gas, right, to overcome the changes in how we eat, right? Okay. And it's probably a lot easier to tell people, okay, you need to fast for 72 hours and then gorge yourself on meat, fast for 24 hours and then, you know, only eat carbs one day. You know, people aren't going to want to do that. And that's maybe not necessarily even, you know, healthy, mm-hmm. right? So get the benefits by just taking in exogenous hydrogen and then it's doing that to your cells. We're getting this these peaks and valleys of hydrogen in our cells, which is what is, you know, perhaps stressing out our mitochondria a bit, making us a bit healthier, you know, impacting all of these systems.
Interesting. It almost reminds me, and it's not the exact same mechanism, but it almost reminds me in the way that adaptogens, kind of like rhodiola or ashwagandha would work, is that they induce something like they can, the way hydrogen's working, like it can work, it can go both ways. It can be, you know, cause oxidative stress and also antioxidant. It can cause inflammation, but also confer antioxidant effects or anti-inflammatory effects, excuse me. And so the adaptogens are kind of the same way. Like if you're feeling low, they'll bump you up and make you feel a little bit higher. If you're overstimulated, they'll kind of bring you back. And so it's kind of like this constant modulatory state that it's doing. And it seems like from the way you're describing hydrogen, just from like the cursory glance I did through the literature in prepping for the podcast, it's much the same thing. It can kind of do what it needs to, when it's needed, where it's needed.
Yeah. And I kind of bite my tongue. I don't use the word adaptogen, even though people get it, because the FDA actually considers that an illegal phrase.
You know, really? All these adaptogen supplements and like anxiety support supplements, you can't say adaptogen anymore?
No. But again, people wonder, like, there's so much misunderstanding in the industry. Mm-hmm. The best way I describe it is FDA enforcement would be like having, you know, 10 state troopers in California or Texas or something looking out for speeders.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Unless you were going 200 miles an hour in a tank ramming people off the road, you're not likely to get caught.
Right.
Right. Unless enough people have complained about you to make the FDA, mm-hmm. you know, pay attention. I recently filed to the FDA. I found, you know, a competitor who's already received warning letters from the FDA is doing something dangerous, putting consumers at risk. And the FDA hasn't acted on them, yeah. right? And I filed to them in December, right? Months ago, right? Yeah. They're so understaffed and underfunded. You know, they just cannot possibly get to everything. They don't have enough money. They don't have enough staff. You know, they've even admitted, they're like, even if we want to go after some of these companies, they have to get the DOJ on board. The DOJ is underfunded, understaffed. So they have their own priorities. It's just, it's a really tragic issue, right? Because otherwise the FDA is a very effective organization. You know, for instance, like, you know, they processed our NDI. It took us years to write our NDI. They were so interactive, asking questions, reviewing, logical. You know, they have PhDs and MDs looking through this. During the government shutdown, you know, like a couple years back, they got our NDI processed ahead of the 75-day schedule. To have similar documents processed in highly bureaucratic countries like, you know, Canada and the EU, mm-hmm. there's like 7 month to 3 year windows that they're never on time for.
Well, yeah, like the NPN process in Canada, I've heard, is a nightmare.
It is, right? And like, I could tell you story after story. I mean, we've reapplied for, you know, some claims on, you know, our NPN process. We're going around about 2.5 years. We filed in June. They didn't acknowledge that we'd filed. They're supposed to acknowledge in 10 days. Mm-hmm. We followed up 10 or 15 times. Finally, in November, they acknowledge receipt, right? Then the first auditor fails us in January, saying we used the wrong form. So what happens is they had updated their form in October. right?
Yeah.
That form didn't exist when we filed in June.
Gotcha. And they failed to notify you that you needed to go back and...
Well, no, they should. They by their regulations, they were supposed to accept us within 10 days, but they didn't.
Gotcha.
So we appealed to the Food Directorate in Canada, and they said, well, it was, you know, the first inspectors, you know, the first agent's fault that they didn't approve you within the schedule. However, you know, the second, you know, like inspector that looked at the file acted according to law because it was an outdated form, so you have to start from scratch, right? So we start from scratch, file again, you know, and we already were basically due to get approved on their timeline, mm-hmm. you know, by then. So we started from scratch, filed, and now they have a longer window, and we're supposed to get, you know, our approval by August.
Mm-hmm.
No response in August, no response in September, no response. You know, October comes, and, you know, we get an email from the Health Canada official saying, you know, this is a complex, you know, application. You know, I'm not sure how to designate it. I'm sending it to, you know, this designation committee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we emailed back in 13 minutes saying we already went through the designation committee. And they told us that, you know, this is the route to go down.
Mm-hmm.
No response, no response, no response. Finally, my consultants escalated it to a supervisor. Supervisor says, oh, it looks like, you know, the Health Canada official had already sent it off to the designation committee before she even emailed you, right, to say she was going to do it.
Yeah.
Right? That's why she hasn't responded. And we said, okay, well, how do we get it back? Because, you know, we put it in our portfolio that had already been designated. Mm-hmm. They said, there is no option to send it back until the designation committee looks at it again. So we said, okay, what's the designation committee's timeline? They said, well, they have no stated timeline. They're overburdened right now, you know, with cases. There is no timeline. You're just going to have to wait. Mm-hmm. So we waited for 14 months, you know, following up every month saying, sorry, we still don't know. We don't know a timeline. We don't even know how many submissions are ahead of you, right? We have too many, right? Before we just started again, right? We just filed again. You know, I have a friend of mine in the industry. I don't want to say who they are because this was confidential. They had something similar happen to Europe. Mm-hmm. You know, they had filed, you know, for their novel food in Europe.
Yeah.
And it's a 2 to 3 year wait time. The server went down and their, you know, submission was lost in Europe. So they were notified, you know, in Europe that their submission had been lost from the system, completely the fault of the EU, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd already waited 2 years. They were coming up to their time and they said, well, we have our submission. We can send it to you. Well, the EU told them, sorry, we cannot guarantee the submission you're sending is the same as what you sent in 2 years ago. They responded, well, you know, you guys have, you know, an option for us to give new information anyways and answer your questions as time is ongoing. So yeah. Why does it matter? And they said, sorry, right? You know, that's not how it works. You have to start from scratch.
Good
right?
Grief.
So it's such a shame, right? Because the FDA is so, in my opinion, well run compared to other agencies, but so underfunded.
It's interesting hearing your spin on it because a lot of the times we hear, or you know, I hear the opposite, or like, you know, the FDA's not doing its job, or it's behind the times, or you know, one of the case in points that I guess one of the personal pet peeves I have is not necessarily their banned ingredient list, but their advisory list that they just kind of put together, where they don't really have any sound backing for saying, hey, this ingredient needs to be on here. All they're saying is, we feel like these ingredients need more research before we can put them in a dietary supplement. But what that happens, it causes a reactionary thing that, you know, servers like Amazon, Shopify, PayPal, the second that they see that ingredient, they take it as it's a banned ingredient, it's dangerous or it's hazardous, and they start pulling companies' products off of these different things, or they stop running the websites and accepting payments and stuff. So that's doing a disservice to those companies And it's all because the FDA put that ingredient on an advisory list when it's not necessarily dangerous at all. It's just we need more research, but they're not going to be funding any additional research for it. So it's interesting to kind of see, you know, we get a different side, like a good look at what the FDA has done in your instance compared to some of the other international governing agencies for dietary supplements.
And I counter that that's on the manufacturers of those ingredients mm-hmm. for never filing to the FDA. Yeah. Because if they had ever filed an NDI or a GRAS application, mm-hmm. right, that would not have happened. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
again, it's this 96% of ingredient suppliers, you know, in the US that have never done their legal obligation to demonstrate our ingredient is safe. These are our manufacturing processes. They're all compliant, mm-hmm. you know, with the law, right? The US has a opt-in. You're opt-in to compliance, whereas other countries enforce compliance. You yeah. have to get approved before you can market. The FDA allows people to, you know, be marketing. The law is you're supposed to submit 75 days before you market, right? But nobody does it, right? So what ends up happening is these companies saying, why am I going to spend a few hundred grand in years, right, putting this together? Why am I going to put together this safety research? You know, people are buying it.
Right.
So to me, it's those ingredient manufacturers not doing the right ethical thing of making sure what they're doing is safe and protected. Because if it works, you know, if their ingredient works, then they want to protect it so a pharmaceutical company can't shut them down.
Yeah.
Right? So there is, in my opinion, unless it's an ingredient that doesn't work and is potentially harmful, mm-hmm. there's no benefit to not filing with the FDA.
That's right? A valid point.
You know, if it works and it's safe, protect yourself. File mm-hmm. it. Right now you're right. protected. You're legally protected. You're protecting your distributors. You're, you know, protecting consumers. You're protecting the market so the pharmaceutical industry can never shut it down. Right. File it. You know, that there's no benefit to not filing other than saving money unless the product doesn't, you know, doesn't work. So they have no fear of a pharmaceutical company or they have no data on safety. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's not saying that it isn't safe. It's saying that they have no evidence if it's safe or not.
Correct. Yeah. Along those lines, can you speak a little bit to, I guess, the cost, expense, and time it takes to putting on? Because you mentioned y'all are currently, I don't know if you're running these clinical trials or you're funding them or not. And you know what? This is one of the major limitations, especially when we see new ingredients come to the market, and even ingredients that have been around like 20 or 30 years. We get one or two studies, maybe in healthy human subjects, maybe in unhealthy human subjects. And we're just left with those one or two studies. We never see anything more. And, you know, one of the things I counter is that these studies cost upwards of six figures. Plus, you have to, you know, secure subjects and all of that stuff. And so,
it can do a lot more. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's what I'd like you to touch on, because people say, why aren't we having more research? And, you know, there's an expense component, but at the same time, it's not like the FDA or the National Institute of Health or Health Canada is giving millions of dollars to supplement companies to fund the research for these chemicals too. So can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. So none of our studies are 100% funded by us. Mm-hmm. We're working with independent teams of researchers from public universities, hospitals all over the world right now.
Okay.
We're doing something that virtually no supplement company or drug company would ever do. It we're putting the fate of our product in the hands of these researchers in the pursuit of truth and honest science. So typically, you know, a company would hire a contract research organization, which might incorporate researchers from a public or private school, maybe not, maybe their CRO centers. I've gotten quotes from some of these CROs, and they are 10 to 15 times higher the cost that, you know, I'll partially donate to of public teams. Now, the difference is, you know, when you are dealing with a CRO and you are the sole funder, right, mm-hmm. you design the protocol and it's your decision if the results see the light of day, right? So you only publish it if it works, right? That way, there is no risk whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's ethical. Personally, I think it should be illegal. right? And I think this model, I'm actually writing a book right now on you know, the deterioration of information, you know, in our society today and access to truth, not just through the media and big data, like in how they're being, you know, skewed to force us, you know, into echo chambers, and even marketing and PR and SEO and all of these things are just really chipping away at truth and changing how things are written and presented, but also faults and solutions in how we conduct science and publish research, right? And fund science, right? So with these costs, you know, a pharmaceutical might cost $1 to $3 billion to make. Well, they're using only CROs, right? There's profit built in to every center. Right. So people are getting rich at every center of doing this, but, you know, in the United States, the you know, healthcare system is largely broken, right? Insurance costs are runaway. All these expenses are runaway. So how can we fix it? How can we get costs down? And how can we make better science, right? Because whether it's a pharma company or a supplement company, they can run a study 10 times and throw away the result of 9 of them until they get what they want to see, right? That's just not right. That doesn't show us what works. That doesn't show us what's safe and effective. So I emailed every researcher that had ever published a paper on hydrogen, you know, in the early days, and said, listen, this is, you know, what I believe in regards to science and the pursuit of truth. I'm willing to donate product, placebo, you know, funds to strengthen the study. Mm-hmm. You guys have final say on study protocol and decision to publish, right? I won't interfere there. And I slowly got some bites, you know, like hesitation. A lot of these researchers didn't want to work with private companies at first. But then when, you know, they found that I was sending the money and signing the agreement that they had right over the design and, mm-hmm. you know, publication, and that I believed in sound science, a lot of them started trusting me more and more and more, and gaining more and more grant dollars to research, you know, my product, because they were seeing benefits and I wasn't interfering in their research. Mm-hmm. Right. And from there, researchers talk, right? So they'd say, oh, by the way, like, you should, you know, work on this product, look at all these results, you know, and he doesn't interfere in the research. Yeah. Right. So that's how we have so rapidly expanded, you know, the amount of clinical research we're doing, is our openness for honest and fair science, you know, truthful science. Now, that comes at a risk. These trials could have all shown that our product did nothing, you know, yeah. And then they're published and the company's dead. But from my perspective, and, you know, my shareholders agree with me, you know, but I you know, handpicked them and I knew them all beforehand. If our product did nothing, we shouldn't be marketing it.
Correct.
You know?
Well put. Do y'all get any input on the actual design of the trial? Since, I mean, this ingredient is your baby. You've devoted years and, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of dollars now into molecular hydrogen and these tablets. So do y'all have any input? Because, you know, say they design a study, but they're designing it around something that wouldn't actually be able to assess the effects of what molecular hydrogen is doing in the body. So do y'all have some kind of oversight into, hey, maybe you should run this kind of test or this kind of assay, or, you know, pull these kind of blood draws
and that's like that? Often end up donating extra funds too, right? Mm-hmm. So I'll have discussions with the professors, and you know, I have my own publications now. I've got multiple under peer review and in press. You know, I've started collaborating with some teams, especially on the preclinical research trials, because mm-hmm. you know, I know the body of research a lot better than a lot of the new teams that are joining. So mm-hmm. yeah, they ask for my input. You know, they ask, you know, if I think this will work. You know, and I'll give my input, but at the end of the day, it's their decision whether they use my input, right, to change how they want to pursue it or not, right? You know, I've had discussions where, you know, a team says, hey, this is what I want to study. And I say, well, you know, mechanistically, we have no evidence that this will work, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, I don't think you should do this study because it's not going to work. Right. And they say, why? Well, what about this? And then we'll start discussing, you know, the context and the situation of this other study where something had a similar result, you know, and why that could have worked and how their design is fundamentally different and is unlikely to see, you know, similar results. And, mm-hmm. you know, for better results, maybe they need a bigger dosage or a longer observation period, you know, or they should be looking at these markers, not that markers. And then, you know, I play kind of matchmaker, you know, a lot between researchers too, and say, hey, listen, like, this isn't really my area of expertise, but Professor so-and-so is working on exactly this right now, mm-hmm. and has a lot of unpublished data, right? I'm going to introduce you to him or her, and you guys can discuss this project, and they can give insight, you know, into you on how to make this better. So I've done a lot of that in connecting a lot of the researchers so they can have good conversations mm-hmm. before they finalize their protocols.
Okay. Transitioning now from the theory and the research side of things into real world applications. First, I'd like to let's discuss, you know, how do you recommend people take this? And then in which application should they be taking this? I guess specifically in regards to maybe sports performance, because we've seen from certain the research things, you mentioned antioxidants earlier, and high dose antioxidants, especially within that peri-workout time frame, you know, with, you know, 3 hours on either side of, you know, resistance training session or interval training session.
Yeah, it bumps the gains.
Say it again?
It bumps the gains, right?
Like, yeah, exactly. That's what I was getting to. So, you know, how does this molecular hydrogen impact that? Does it boost performance? Is it having some of those unwanted antioxidant, anti-inflammatory effects? Can you speak to that?
Sure. And this is where it actually gets really cool and why it really makes sense. And, you know, and it's again why I really, a lot of marketers and a lot of researchers, for simplicity, even like will call hydrogen an antioxidant. It's not. Hydrogen is an incredibly weak antioxidant in vivo, right? There's no evidence it works directly as an antioxidant within a living organism, mm-hmm. right? But in vivo, the reason why it was interesting is it's such a weak antioxidant that it bypassed most oxidative, the nitrosative stressors, and only reduced the hydroxyl radical and peroxynitrite, right? The most reactive, damaging ones.
Right.
But there's no evidence that it does that, you know, in the body. It only does it, you know, in cell cultures, as far as we know right now. So mm-hmm. there's been some really cool, you know, studies that have looked at inflammation and oxidative stress, you know, in say rats, you know, in whether they are subjected to hydrogen or not, like before and during exercise. Mm-hmm. And it shows that during exercise, hydrogen is actually increasing the stress in the same activity. So the oxidative stress is actually peaking higher than just exercise alone. Mm-hmm. However, following exercise, right, the NRF2 activation, the antioxidant activation, is faster and stronger, driving back to, you know, homeostatic redox quicker. So it's almost as if the same exercise is contributing to a higher stress. So you worked out harder, but then you recovered quicker, right? You know, we've seen good results, you know, in athletes and you know, in research studies using hydrogen for athletic performance, including, you know, with our bath tablets. You know, we had one clinical trial that showed it was equivalent in trending better to Rice protocol after grade 2 ankle tears, right? You know, we have another that showed a single bath significantly reduced delayed onset muscle soreness, mm-hmm. both by the VAS scale and by measurements of creatine kinase, right? So, you know, there's some cool data there. Basically, yeah, hydrogen isn't just an antioxidant to, like, you know, blunt hypertrophy gains, right? It's not going to do that. It's going to potentiate, you know, the acute stress, but then help you recover quicker. This is kind of, you touch base on how things can do two things at once, and it's really interesting. So we not only have research underway exploring improvements of sleep, right? Mm-hmm. But we have a clinical trial showing that hydrogen raises alertness equivalent to caffeine after sleep deprivation. And we have a second publication under peer review that even went deeper using fMRI, you know, to monitor, you know, like the brain after either hydrogen or caffeine or both of them together. So building on the first study, it definitely shows that you know, hydrogen and caffeine have different effects on the brain, mm-hmm. but the fMRI data shows hydrogen has a more robust, you know, activity in altering brain metabolism than caffeine, right? Okay. So, you know, it's really interesting how it both simultaneously seems to be able to help with sleep, you know, and we have some unpublished data here on sleep. It's the biggest testimonial we hear is improved sleep. There's a couple, you know, mentions of sleep in the hydrogen research, you know, in humans too. There's also mentions of, you know, improving like mood and anxiety and stuff like that in human clinical research. So hydrogen is simultaneously seeming to work, helping people's mood and anxiety, helping people sleep better, but acting sort of as a stimulant, right? But it isn't like a stimulant like caffeine that gets you high and gives you jitters. Mm-hmm. The best way to describe it is the absence of feeling tired.
Okay.
Right? So when you take it, when you're super tired, you don't feel like you just had like, you know, a quadruple espresso or something. You're wired, ready to go.
Yeah.
You just start working and you realize, I feel okay now.
Mm-hmm. Right. With the dosing and the administration of it, is it something that you notice the effects of? So say you want to get the exercise benefits of it or the sleep benefits of it. Should you take it immediately before those activities to where it's something similar to like a caffeine where its effects are acute onset? Or is it something more analogous to creatine where it's something you want to take every day and like its effects compound over time and you'll notice it maybe after 3 or 4 weeks of taking it consistently?
And this can be a little bit, you know, complex, but the basic advice is if you're taking it for exercise performance, I'd say take it about 10 minutes before you exercise,
mm-hmm.
right? You're going to see potentially acute performance improvements if you take it immediately before. Mm-hmm. However, if you say take it after in the morning, you'll see the longer term benefits like a creatine, like slowly taking over time. Okay. If you're not exercising, I tend to say take it on an empty stomach, whether it's first thing in the morning or a few hours after lunch, something like mm-hmm. that. And the reason for this is one of my pending patents shows that, you know, I can create like foams and gels by combining various polysaccharides with hydrogen gas, right? So these polysaccharides are retaining hydrogen gas in them. What that means is you could be turning your high dose like acutely
mm-hmm.
into a continuous dose that might take a couple hours to seep out, because these right. foams and gels are semi-stable. So I'd say drink your hydrogen water on an empty stomach, mm-hmm. right before exercise, you know, if you're going to work out. But otherwise, popular times are first thing in the morning, you know, mid-afternoon. A lot of people end up getting really tired a few hours after lunch, you know, nearing the end of the day. Mm-hmm. We get a lot of reports of people saying that's when they drink their hydrogen, you know, to pick them up and finish the last, you know, 2-3 hours of work.
Yeah.
Also, there's not good evidence on this yet, but there's one study that was like several years that it seems to have lost the benefit, right, by year three. Right, very strong benefits at the start, and then by year three, there's no benefits anymore. So very interesting. We've gotten that anecdotally a lot,
mm-hmm.
right? People saying after a year, a little over a year, hey, like this isn't working for me anymore, right? And again, anecdotally, just exploring it the same way of thinking like exercise, we've told those people to stop taking it for a week and then completely change their routine. Different time of day, different dose, everything. And overwhelmingly, all those people were messaging back and saying it's working again, right?
So
I recommend, same thing with exercise. If you run, you know, 6 miles every day at the same pace, right? Yeah. You're going to start putting on fat, losing muscle, becoming unhealthy because it's no longer exercise.
Right. Just the normal state of affairs.
Exactly. Right. So I tend to recommend developing a protocol, you know, and you can develop a few, cycle through them, and take X amount at X time a day for about 6 months,
mm-hmm.
and then take a week off, right? Take no hydrogen for a week and then change it. If you were taking it before your exercise, maybe take a different dose, but in the morning mm-hmm. on an empty stomach for the next 6 months, right? And just keep cycling through like that. And the one long-term study on patients on dialysis that showed very strong benefits after the first year, and then they tapered off by the end of the few years, it was the same dose at the same time every day for years. Okay. Right? And you saw this.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. With this, how, I guess, describe to the listeners that may not have tried this before. So we dissolve the tablets in water. Do we need to use a special jug to do this? Since, I mean, it's releasing gas. Does it give it like a carbonated type taste or feel? Or like does it feel like you're drinking like carbonated water? Touch on that a little bit.
It's different than carbonated water, right? It's a lot lighter.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like lighter on your tongue. Now, we have magnesium in there. That's how we're splitting the hydrogen off the water, right? Because the hydrogen gas is coming from water. So it'll taste a bit like minerals, like a mineral water. We also have organic acids that, help catalyze or act as catalysts in the reaction. Mm-hmm. So it kind of tastes like a little bit like a heavy mineral water with like some lemon juice is okay. the easiest way to describe it. But we also have flavor tablets, have some sweetness and some raspberry flavor. So mm-hmm. some people prefer those. Doesn't taste like carbonated water at all. And the novelty of, my technology is we figured out how to retain the gas for a very short period of time, by creating very small nanobubbles, mm-hmm. right? So usually people have heard the expression, the smaller you get, the weirder physics gets. Well, that starts, with molecules that we work with every day, right? Basically, when you go below about, 5 microns in size, and sorry for using the metric system, for all the American listeners, gases and particles no longer will sink or float. They just kind of suspend, right? And this is what's going on, when they're talking in the news about aerosols, the coronavirus, right? Yeah. That these super fine aerosols will stay in the air for hours and just travel everywhere. So we're actually, going even smaller, about 1,000 times, upwards of 1,000 times smaller, and making these very small range nanobubbles. Now these nanobubbles, when you look under, say a microscope, they're working kind of like these eddy currents. They're going in every which way, and it's retaining this cloud of gas. So this is how we're getting 12 ppm, because under normal circumstances, you can only dissolve 1.6 ppm of hydrogen in water under, atmospheric pressure, normal mm-hmm. temperatures, right? Everything like that. So we're getting, 7-8 times higher than that because it's not dissolved. It's quasi-dissolved in these nanobubbles, mm-hmm. which is stable enough for you to drink down, right? So you want to drink it very quickly because the bubbles slowly coalesce mm-hmm. together. And as they exceed 5 microns, they dissipate out of the air, right? They're gone. So the quicker you drink it, the better, right? I usually just use a mug, kind of like a beer mm-hmm. mug, 16, 17-ounce beer mug. Some mm-hmm. of our research uses 8 ounces, 250 milliliters, especially research incorporating, older people that maybe can't guzzle down, 16 ounces in one go. They'll use 8, gets about 80% of the gas retained. It's, if you use a smaller volume of water, you get a higher concentration, but it's not linear. It's not 100%, effective. So it's not 100%, transference. And the smaller you get, the worse that percentage is. So don't go lower than 8 ounces, but you can go up to 16, 17 ounces. I say use room temperature, right? We designed it around room temperature because room temperature helps with the reaction, right? Okay. To a little bit of heat there. Also, it's really hard to guzzle cold water, yep. right? It's really easy to guzzle room temperature water.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm glad you mentioned drinking it quickly. So this isn't something where if I have a gallon of water, I just pop a few tablets in and I can just stick it in the refrigerator or leave it on my desk all day. And just, you wouldn't recommend doing that. Just do it kind of like on an individual serving basis.
Exactly. Right. So say you do that, two things are happening. One, the hydrogen's leaving the water, right? you know, it goes from, say, the 12, you know, ppm, milligrams a liter, down to 1.6 in a matter of 5-6 minutes.
Okay.
Right? From there, it's only a two-hour half-life. So in 2 hours, you're down to 0.8. Right? You know, after 4 hours, you're below the minimum observed therapeutic dose, the lowest that any dose has ever worked under any situation. On top of that, if you have it in, you know, a gallon of water and you're sipping all day, you're just doing that continuous dose. You're getting a little bit trickling in all the time. So you're not going to be spiking your cellular concentrations. You know, so you want to do it, you know, in 8 to 16 ounces of water and slam it all back.
Right? Playing devil's advocate, because if there's a way for something to be done wrong, there's a human being out there that will find a way for it to be done, or they will do it that way. So can you just pop a tablet and then chug 8 ounces of water right back? Like, people dry scoop all kinds of like supplement powders or capsules. So can they toss back a couple of tablets of this and then chug, you know, 16 ounces of water?
People do that. I know they do that. It's going to be safe, but there's going to be that one in a million where it isn't. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? In almost all circumstances, it's just going to react with your stomach acid and the water that you're drinking. It's going to be fine. Mm-hmm. I've got to admit, I've done it before myself when I'm rushing out the door.
Yeah.
We can't recommend it. And especially if someone has GI issues, if you're elderly, you know, things like that, what can happen is, one, the tablets could get stuck mm-hmm. on the way down. They're exothermic, right? It could cause burns on the way down. Two, it could lodge in your stomach lining and cause an ulcer, right? If, say, you don't drink water with it, you don't have enough stomach acid, right? It could sit there and slowly burn a hole in your stomach lining, because it will get warm, right? Yeah. So it will get hot. You know, if you put a little bit of water and you put it on your hand, you know, to me, it's just painful because I have darker skin. But, you know, my wife is very fair redhead, and she'll blister a little bit, you know, she does. So it's one of those things, kind of like, you know, concentrated hot coffee. You know, for some people, it might burn your skin off. For other people, it just stings and then tingles, and you're fine. Mm-hmm. And that's just if it's sitting directly on there, like on your skin, right? Yeah. Like, not when you're drinking the water. So when you're drinking water, that heat is diffused throughout all the water, and it doesn't even go up a degree, you know, because it goes through everywhere. But if you just swallow it down and it gets stuck in your throat, that's that concentrated heat on a very small spot.
Right.
And again, that's pretty rare, and you could sit there drinking water and it's going to dissolve away and unlodge, right? Mm-hmm. But if someone's really, really dumb and they just swallow a bunch and they don't take water, it could do damage in their throat, right? It you know, could sit against their stomach lining and cause an ulcer. So don't do it, you know? And I know I just said that I've done it, you know, the odd time. You know, I know the odds, it's maybe a one in a million, like, especially if you chug water down with it, but still don't do it, right? Because, you know, you might, again, not drink a liter like I chug it with when I've been running out the door. And just why? It only takes a minute, you know? And yeah, every time I've done it, I've thought to myself, like, why do I do that? I tell everyone else not to do it. Yeah. I'm not following my own guidance and advice.
Yeah. If you got time for a few more questions, I'd like to get into some of your, maybe some of your personal training, diet, stuff like that. Cause obviously you mentioned that you have some martial arts experience. You've done some CrossFit stuff. What is your daily, weekly training look like, and personal supplementation habits outside of obviously the hydrogen tablets?
Yeah. So basically, I don't train nearly as much as I used to because I can't. I've got arthritis in 11 spots. My body is broken. You know, I played football 11 or 12 years, you know, a decade of martial arts and CrossFit. It's just, you know, I'm kind of the broken / tin man right now. But I still, you know, I've got my own Muay Thai bag, you know, on my patio with mats. So I hit that, you know, 4 times a week. You know, I haven't been able to spar because of COVID for a long time, but I'd usually go train. I play soccer, you know, again, canceled because of COVID. right now I am doing like working on technique with you know, southpaw boxing, kickboxing coach, right? Because my left shoulder, I've really switched from orthodox to southpaw, so that I have an active, you know, lead hand. I obviously can't do CrossFit anymore, but I've got plyo, you know, plyo boxes, you know, on my patio. So I do a lot of jumping, a lot of stuff like that that doesn't incorporate putting a lot of pressure on my shoulder. The big one, and I was gaining a lot of weight because, I mean, I used to eat like 8,000 calories a day and I was 170 pounds. It got to a point where I couldn't find the right workouts, and I got up to like 267 eating 2,200 calories a day, right? So it just, like, my metabolism was shutting down. I wasn't doing well with the exercises I was doing. So that's kind of when I got back into modifying martial arts and jumping, but not ever doing it to failure. And, you know, I've lost over half the weight, you know, and I don't have a perfect diet. I drink wine twice a week, you know, have a burger and fries or pizza once a week, you know what I mean? But, you know, I've been able to get down fluctuating between like 215 to 225, which, you know, is dropping 40-50 the pounds, you know, between it. And what I've done is I've just taken out heavy lifting, so my muscles aren't ever as sore, right? So I do things like high intensity jumping, martial arts, but I walk at least an hour every day. And it's just that low impact walk that burns more fat and calories than a lot of high intensity stuff. I'm fortunate. I live in Vancouver, Canada. We have, you know, so many parks, so much nature, and it's green all year round here. Right. So I've just started taking advantage of that, you know, and other little things too. Like, if people listening are like me, sitting at a computer all day long, especially, like, you know, on top of all the calls, podcasts, like emails I'm doing, I write a lot. I've written 500,000 words of content over the last 2 years. I'm working on 3 books, multiple publications. I get up about once every hour and I just do a chore in my house for 5-10 minutes. Nothing that takes me away from working, but I just kind of maintain my house and I start chipping away at something for 5-10 minutes just to get me moving, get my heart rate up, and stop being sedentary. And I think that's super important. Things like standing desks, you know, treadmills like at your desk could be good, but also you want proper rest, you know, too. So you don't want to be standing all day long. That can put pressure on your joints.
Anything on the supplementation side? Do you do the coffee, nootropics, pre-workouts, anything like that?
So I've been taking some products. You know, we're actually launching them really soon. I take the Ageless Defense product we have on our site every day. I spent about 16 months, you know, myself and, you know, Dr. Holland helped. That's for advanced clarification and product cross-linking, right? Okay. So it's a dozen, you know, natural ingredients that have shown in research to either inhibit formation of ages, you know, protect against their damages, or even break some ages. Ages are in our body, you know, it's one of the main causes of aging, right? It leads to, you know, can lead to, you know, neurological issues. It can lead to, you know, stiffening of our arterial walls, you know, heart disease, diabetes. You know, it can, you know, lead to sarcopenia, like weakening of our muscles. It's even one of the two causes of wrinkles, you know, ages destroying our collagen and UV damage combined to cause wrinkles. So they're basically these sugar links, you know, within our body, and you get them in all day, no matter what your diet is, you know, because we'll take in ages through, you know, smoke particles in the air, right? We'll take in ages, and think of ages as, it's like the browning, you know, of a steak or bread. Those are ages. Yeah. We're doing that to food, right? So you can say impact your ages, like lower your ages by not consuming any carbohydrates like that have glucose, by lowering your blood sugar, but then you're getting them exogenously if you're cooking your meat.
Yeah.
Right? You know, because as soon as you brown your meat, those are just ages, and about 30% of those are going to stick around and stay in your body and form links. Mm-hmm. So unless you're eating a raw diet, you know, which has its own negative impacts, yep. right? You're getting ages no matter what your diet is, right? So I take that to protect against ages, and we actually have clinical research ongoing with ages defense. And some products that I have been taking, you know, through various things that we're developing, we're actually, it'll probably launch before this podcast goes out, because we're launching next Friday, you know, on the 12th. Mm-hmm. Our one product is called Boost, right? And it's hydrogen tablets, 1.5 grams of nitrosygen, right? Mm-hmm. Which is silicon bonded arginine, yep. and 200 milligrams of caffeine for total, you know, mind and body stimulation, right? And the other is called Build, right? And it's just really simple, and I take all this stuff myself. It's 5 grams of creatine, right? 3 grams of beta alanine and 3 grams of HMB, right? And in our research, there's not a single company that put those three ingredients, which are probably the three most well-researched and backed, you know, ingredients for improving, you know, muscle endurance, performance, and muscle recovery. Nobody's put them together, probably because of cost, right? Because our you know, our margins are a lot lower than companies usually want. But again, kind of in you know, my mission to put out stuff that's actually working and beneficial, I don't want to put out something in doses that doesn't work, right? Yeah. But if we're doing it, you know, we're doing it, you know, mm-hmm. and we'll figure out the margins later. And, you know, if we can't run $1 million ad campaigns, then so be it. I want a good product that I can stand behind.
That's very admirable. That's what it's about, or, you know, getting away from the salacious, you know, muscle tech ads of the 90s where it's saying, take this pill and boost bicep growth by 687% or something like that. So,
you know, and guys I know that used to train with had been part of the studies that some supplement companies come on.
Yeah.
And, you know, these companies would be like, you know, get on the gear. You know what I mean? You're in the active group. So go on cycle. Right. And they'd get paid to do it.
Yeah.
You know, and these studies either are not published in a scientific journal or published in a predatory journal, and right. they're only used for advertising.
Correct.
Right. So, oh yeah, you know, our pre-workout had a 600%, you know, muscle gain over placebo. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well,
you know, that was a unblinded study, you know, and you told all your bodybuilders to go on juice, you know, exactly. at the start of it, you know, like,
yeah. come on. Yeah. Awesome, Alex. Well, this was a very eye-opening discussion. I really enjoyed it. I hadn't done much into molecular hydrogen research before we connected and set up this podcast, but it's one of those kind of, I mean, there's so many areas and avenues you can go on with dietary supplements. You can do general health, you can do like blood sugar, you can do anti-aging, you can do sports performance, cognitive boosting, things like that. So, I mean, it's really cool to kind of get in all these different niches of the supplement industry. So I'm glad we were able to set this up. So thank you for your time and your knowledge today.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Is there anything you can shamelessly plug anything and anything you want to right now, if you'd like?
Yeah. I mean, check us out, you know, on our website, you know, like, we write a lot of content. Like I said, like I've written like 500,000 words of content in the last couple of years. We have multiple PhDs and MDs that are writing good, well-researched, you know, content. And one of the things too is we'll brainstorm topics, but I don't force any of our writers to say anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're writing about things they find are important. I do my biohacking reviews. My marketing team often gets upset at me, and they say, you know, if you say these products work and we get affiliate codes, we can increase our bottom line. And I say, well, when I run these N1 tests and I find no evidence that this worked, right, you know, yeah. in the data I'm collecting, and their research is bogus or non-existent too, I can't say this works so that we get a 20% affiliate plug or something like that. Exactly. So we put out a lot of content like that, breaking down things, and it, you know, follow us on Instagram too. We've got, you know, something like several dozen pro athletes that are posting about us all the time and endorsing us. That's all a truth and transparency policy too. We always set athletes up with care packages. Sometimes, in some cases, athletes were taking our stuff for, you know, 8-9 months or a couple instances even more before we worked out a deal, because we never want an athlete to endorse us if they don't use the product and see a benefit,
right?
And we try and get away with like scripted stuff for them to say too. We just say, hey, be honest, you know, talk about your experience. One other thing that I'm working on, sign up for the newsletter, because it's going to come just slowly, because we're all volunteers. It's a not-for-profit. You know, we're founding a not-for-profit called myjourney.science. So my journey with science, it's myjourney.science. And basically the thought is, we are collecting so much data, you know, as a society every day on our wearable technologies, whether it's an Oura Ring or a Fitbit or an Apple Watch. Hundreds of millions, if not a billion plus people, are wearing these technologies every day. We have more data that we're waking up to in the morning and seeing about our health than the top labs had a few decades ago, right? We could really start knowing, you know, if some of these supplements, you know, ingredients, devices work, diets, exercise programs work, right? We could gather data exponentially faster than researchers are able to get funding. People just need to know how to conduct science. So we have tutorials teaching people how to do an N of one on yourself, a case study on yourself, just basically showing the importance of a control, the importance of tracking data, the importance of only doing one thing at a time, right? So slowly we're going to get all these tutorials out, you know, like some of the tutorials are out already, and slowly we're going to start getting all these templates out so people can register and say, hey, I want to do something for athletic performance, and it'll have a list of things they can try. You know, they download a template, you know, go through it, and either it worked or they didn't, and they fill out their results, and that'll attract 80% of users found a benefit here.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and then it can guide researchers to say, huh, this seems to be working with consumers in this controlled atmosphere. We'll take donations, we'll, you know, sell placebos, and, you know, probably get some referral commissions from different devices and services and stuff like that. Yeah. But all that money will be used, you know, as a not-for-profit to donate to public researchers wanting to study, you know, anything on our site that they're seeing a benefit from.
Yeah.
In the next phase, we'll be adding the option for users to confidentially, you know, upload their you know, DNA results, right? So with their name not attached, just as a user X type thing, which will only be available to public researchers, because basically genetic responder studies can cost millions of dollars, so they don't get done, right? And we believe the future is in personalized medicine, but we need the data to go from widespread medicine to personalized medicine. Right. So as we get more users and start collecting this data, researchers can look and say, hey, it looks like, you know, 70% of people are finding a strong benefit with no side effects doing this, but 10% of people are finding no benefit and side effects. Can we look at, you know, the DNA data you have, and they could identify what's going on, right, to help give better personalized health advice? You know, maybe for one person, you know, they could say, hey, like the ketogenic diet might work great for you. For another person, say, don't try the ketogenic diet. You could have really bad results from it. Yeah. And that's just as one example, right? And, you know, diet might be where we see the biggest differences, right? Because, I mean, I personally think that the best diet is going to be individual-based, depending on your genetic makeup, your microbiome, and your activity level.
Absolutely. Absolutely. 100%. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Alex. This will debut shortly. I really appreciate the time, and look forward to hopefully doing this again when we get some more data on the tablets.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks.